Great news, everyone. This month, Hodinkee is expanding its pre-owned watch offering with a special collection of 500 fun and collectible pre-owned watches. Each and every watch has been verified for authenticity and condition, and if you'd like to see the whole collection, just visit hodinkee.com/shop. As an extra bit of fun, we'd love to see your favorite pre-owned watches. Just share a photo on Instagram and use the hashtag #BetterWithTime. And don't forget to check the sticker section if you're in need of some fresh new flair. All right, let's get to the show. Hey, it's me, James Stacey, and today we're here to cover some of the biggest stories in the world of watches and probably a bit beyond. To help me out, please welcome this week's panel of Hodinkee's best and brightest. First up, I've never seen him and the world's most interesting man in the same room, so that's something to think about. It's our illustrious EIC, Jack Forster. How you doing?
Doing great. Hi, James.
That's a pleasure to have you here, Jack.
Pleasure to be here.
Next up, those with keen ears will recognize her voiceover talents, and without her, I'd be lost somewhere in the hell between a Word document and a Google spreadsheet. It's our lovely deputy editor, Nora Taylor. How we doing, Nora?
Great.
Excellent. And last up, but a long way from least, if we had a studio audience, they'd be going nuts for him right now. It's senior editor, John Buse. How you doing, John?
Doing well, James. Thank you very much for having me on today.
Oh, this is going to be a good one, because there's been some interesting stuff, and I was on vacation, so I haven't really dipped into much of it. I kind of did some prep yesterday on the plane, but some kind of cool stuff came up, and I wanted to start with a story that Jack wrote that's actually based on a story from another Hodinkee contributor for the Financial Times. Robin wrote a story about some comments made by the current CEO of Seiko. Jack, do you want to bring people up to speed on that and kind of why it's an interesting, I think, really interesting thing, actually?
Yeah, sure. Happy to. It was by the standards of watch industry CEO announcements, it was surprisingly frank and blunt. So Akio Naito became CEO of Seiko Watch Corporation last April, I believe, and he's been at the job for a little bit of time now. Prior to that, he was running Grand Seiko USA, and he said that he thought that Seiko really needed a little bit of a wake-up call. I'm going to paraphrase a little bit. His feeling was, and what he said to Robin Swithenbank at the FT, was that the company had for too long tried to be all things to all people, which certainly, if you look at the company's history from a price point standpoint, is not necessarily true across the board for the entire history of Seiko in the United States. But with the introduction of Grand Seiko to the market, all of a sudden we have watches made by Seiko and branded Seiko and Grand Seiko that cover a really, really enormous price range, you know, from a few multiples of tens of dollars all the way up to roughly $100,000. And his feeling was that Seiko has become, in trying to be all things to all people, it's sort of become too diffuse, too general, and the company doesn't really have a strong identity because it's really almost a bunch of different companies operating under a single corporate structure.
And I mean, Jack, would you agree with that assessment? Do you think, like, as a roughly newly minted CEO, that's probably a strong way of looking at how they should be addressing their moves going forward?
I mean, it was certainly an extraordinary thing to say, because typically watch brand CEOs say things like, everything is absolutely fine, we have an incredibly strong identity, all our movements are made in-house by, you know, elves working in hollow trees in the mountains of whatever mountainous country you care to pick. But yeah, I think that it is true to a certain extent. You know, if you think about the number of different kinds of timekeeping technologies, the number of price points, and the sheer variety of watches that Seiko offers, you know, I want to be careful to distinguish Seiko from Grand Seiko, because they've gone to a lot of trouble to make sure that we sort of don't talk about them as if they're the same company. And they do have actually different management structures. But taken as a whole, they function a little bit more like a group than like a single watch company. So you think of Rolex, and you have a very singular sort of identity in mind, despite the sheer number of watches that they make. You think of Omega, and despite the fact that they make a huge variety of watches, they also have kind of a singular identity, for me centered around the Speedmaster, and for a lot of people as well. But still, you know, you have a sense of who those companies are. You talk about Seiko, and you've got everything. You've got a huge, huge, huge range of watches that really feels more analogous to, say, talking about Swatch Group or the Richemont Group than it feels like talking about a single watch company.
Yeah. It's a funny thing for him to say that about Seiko proper, because Seiko is this huge thing, and then they have like sister brands, Loris and Alba, I believe, way back in the day was kind of a dive watch offshoot of a brand that already made arguably the best dive watches at the price point anyways. So it is kind of an interesting thing for them to say that about their core when they also have these wings that are kind of off-produced. And that's before we even get to the NH stuff, the kind of third-party resale of movements and such. John, what do you think the identity is for Seiko right now?
Yeah, no, I mean, I was just going to add on a few additional names. Like even within Seiko, you have, of course, like Prospects and Presage, like even within the brand, you know. So it's, yeah, Seiko. And then, of course, as Jack mentioned, there's, you know, Grand Seiko, which is its own, you know, separate thing. But of course, you know, we know where it originated from and where it came from. Yeah, I mean, Seiko is massive. If you think about the context of Japanese watchmaking, they are the biggest thing there is. And they do everything in-house because they have to, because they're not, you know, in Switzerland, they're not in Europe. So I think it's a really interesting point that Akio Naito made, you know, that they have kind of become everything for everyone. But I think it's almost like a necessary, if you're going to be that big and if you're going to be so dominant in your country as a watchmaker, it seems like a very natural state of affairs for it to have gotten to that point. But it's interesting that he made the point in such a public way and in such a, you know, largely read publication.
I do, not to totally steal your job, James, have a question.
Oh, please.
Yeah. Which is that from sort of observing Seiko, how we write about it, how people respond to it, it seems like the company has a ton of goodwill. Like people love it. And they are, if not as obsessively collecting it as they are like Rolex, they are very fond of the brand. And so I'm wondering if there is a sense that like, if there is a way to winnow down on the brand's identity without losing that goodwill, which kind of I think comes from being something for everybody.
Yeah, I would say I think they'd have to discover kind of the sweet spot of all these many kind of different lineages they have and then preserve that and try and maybe trim some of the fat. But it's kind of a weird challenge because there is a different sort of ethos to the way that some of these huge Japanese companies work. If you think of companies like Mitsubishi, Epson, you might know Mitsubishi for making cars, but they make sewing machines and they make tanker boats and they make giant industrial engines and motors and things like that. These are companies that often have hundreds of arms into different businesses. And I think it came naturally to Seiko. We're still talking about all watches, generally speaking, right?
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned Epson, which is interesting because that in itself is part of Seiko. So that kind of goes to the point of how big Seiko is, you know?
They have this rather Byzantine corporate structure as well. It's an intellectual challenge in and of itself just to figure out which holding company is actually responsible for which brands and kind of who produces what. So, you know, Epson is, as John pointed out, part of Seiko as well. And I have read breakdowns of Seiko's corporate structure overall on a bunch of different occasions. And it sticks in my head as poorly as Patek Philippe reference numbers. I just can't.
Yeah, it's tough.
You know, this is my business and I can't keep track of exactly, you know, what goes where. And if we're just talking about watches, to Nora's point, one of the things that is really fantastic about Seiko is that they do offer such a huge variety of products. And People do get very attached to them because they're increasingly isolated in terms of offering, you know, relatively affordable mechanical watches. You know, when I first started getting into mechanical watches, my first wristwatch was a Seiko 5. My first mechanical wristwatch was a Seiko 5. My second mechanical wristwatch was a Diver. It was the SKX 007. So Seiko is the entry point to this wonderful little addiction of ours, this wonderful little hot, which is now not so little, actually. But I don't know. For them to – I understand why they split off Grand Seiko from Seiko, because I think that that was a critical sort of move for them in order to distinguish the higher-end product from the stuff that's more democratically priced. And I think one of the disadvantages, though, of offering so many different products is it feels these days like no sooner do you get attached to a particular model than it's discontinued and replaced by something kind of incrementally similar but just different enough that you have to fall in love all over again.
Like Trader Joe's.
It's like Trader Joe's, yeah.
Yeah.
Where are my Marcona almonds? This is all I want. Goodness sake.
That's a really good analogy.
Delicious. And it's a funny thing that you mentioned the Grand Seiko thing, because that's what came to my mind is I felt like they kind of already did this once. They wanted to make sure that the higher end price point had its own home, its own philosophy. It's these sort of soft walls, a garden, if you will. And to leave the Seiko, you know, sort of Seiko proper in like Jack said, the more democratic price point where it already was. I wonder if they'll decide to kind of break in so Prospects will become kind of its own brand rather than a wing of I don't know how you break up something this big. And also, I think there's something good in almost everything, every line, every sort of thought process that they take on watches, and they can make watches so quickly and to such a high level of quality relative to the price point. I wonder where they'll, I don't know where you go like, well, we just don't need this anymore. It's, you know, you might cut something that doesn't sell in North America that sells beautifully in South America or Central Europe or, you know, in more, you know, closer to home countries around Japan. It's a, I think this would be a huge challenge. It's interesting, not only that they would recognize it and vocalize it to a major publication, but that it came right from the CEO. It's a, I think, quite promising for the brand. Pragmatic as well.
I mean, I agree. We'll see what happens. I don't see them eliminating entire product lines, though. I mean, or breaking them off. Is there really a market for prospects if it's not Seiko prospects anymore?
Yeah, then it's Alba or Loris, or like it becomes some of these ones that I feel we've kind of seen them and they show up in various markets. Like, I don't actually know. Like, is Loris something that you would also find in the States? Probably, right?
You did.
I know it from, like, you know, malls in Canada. So I don't know if sometimes they were making these thinner and thinner slices for smaller and smaller markets. And maybe they need to go in the other direction.
It's funny. We've kicked around the term mall watch, and I've actually tried to kick it to death a couple of times on the site. But there used to be a whole category of watches that were called drugstore watches that don't exist anymore. And, you know, you would find these, I'm sure you had these in Canada as well. When you were a kid, James, you'd walk into a drugstore and you'd see these rotating displays of affordably priced watches. And that, I think $30 would have been pushing it. And you would see entry-level Casios and entry-level Seikos, all battery-powered quartz. And that was sort of what Alba was. At least some of their products were, you know, what we used to call drugstore watches.
Yeah. Up here, you'd see, it would just be a watch that said quartz really big on it, which is like fine. Like, and you buy it next to a pair of Foster Grant sunglasses or something like that. Yeah, at the drugstore, for sure.
I kind of miss drugstore watches.
I do too, actually.
Let's buy some.
If you were really lucky, there would be also a carousel next to the drugstore watches of drugstore watch bands.
That's right.
Oh, yeah. I had a few of those. I had a really good one for a Timex way back in the day that was like a sort of very busy pattern on a Velcro strap. And when I say busy, like almost ludicrously so. Like one
like
of those.
A Trapper Keeper or something?
Yeah, or like that. Or like one of those Patagonia, like Cinchillas. It was just because there's a lot happening.
Saved by the Bell opening credits.
Exactly. Yes, exactly. Thank you, Dora. Thank you very much. Yes. It was, you could wear a little bit of that vibe with your Iron Man, which, you know, 8-year-old James really liked that a lot. to these days, I would just, if they've made a gray one, that's what I'd be buying. All right. So I think that's the Seiko story. I think this is really interesting. You should definitely check out the post. We'll put it in the show notes and link out to Robin's piece for the Financial Times. I think it's a fascinating story. I'm really interested to see how this develops in their communications moving forward. Because like once the CEO kind of says it, they're going to have to reference it in some way, either with direct decisions that we'll have to kind of glean or more directly in communication. And I think it'll be interesting to see what we see as far as their strategy change and if the strategy will even affect this market, let's say the North American market, versus all these other places that they're managing. So I'd consider this something of a developing story. I look forward to chatting with you guys at length about it in the future. Next up, I did want to get to, because we've got two stars of Heiho Denki here on the call, which I'm pretty excited about. So this is a relatively new product. How many episodes have we done so far?
Didn't we just do episode 6?
Yeah, we just put up episode 6 and recorded 7, 8, 9 yesterday.
Yeah, I'm sure you guys have recorded a ton. They're not numbered, so I thought I'd ask. But so Heiho Denki is this new kind of a product that we've launched. If you've missed it and you're managing to listen to the podcast, I'm a huge fan of yours for doing so. But you should also check out Heiho Denki. It's been really fun so far. So it's basically a you know, a community question and answer, and it's Jack in front of the camera, kind of off script, and I've really been enjoying it. And I think even this most recent one, which came up just this morning as we're recording it, this will be a few days before the podcast goes up. And I thought this was really fun because it brought up a question I've never once thought about was like, should I be buried with my watch? I think I changed my mind like 2 times during this. So Jack, you're the host of this. Nora, you're the voice of the audience. You're the God voice in there, unless I'm misattributing somehow.
No, that's all me, baby.
That's fantastic. So I like this a lot. I think this is a really solid thing. You know, I think like a lot of people, I wish they were more like 10 or 15 minutes. But also knowing how much work it takes to make anything, it's quite a stretch. So I want to get to getting buried with your watch because I think this is a great question that I never thought about. But Jack, tell me about how this kind of project kind of launched and what it's like to shoot them.
Well, we thought to ourselves, you know, we have historically done a fair amount of pretty high touch, fairly technically sophisticated videos. And we wanted to do something that felt a little bit more immediate, a little bit more, not run and gun necessarily, but something that was a little bit different from some of the more serious, you know, Talking Watches, for example, is certainly our most popular video franchise, but it's a significant amount of work to do. You have to find a collector to work with and hope that they're good on camera. And, you know, every single episode is sort of an encyclopedic look at a collection that it is potentially encyclopedic in its depth and breadth. And Hey Ho Dinky gives us a way of doing something that's a little bit quicker and lighter, but also lets us sort of talk directly to the audience, which is something I don't think we've ever really done in video before. I think the closest we probably came was a few times on the late Lamented Friday Live. Well, I say late Lamented Friday Live, but it's certainly not lamented by the folks who had to put it together technically every week. I think they still have PTSD from setting up an entire television studio every Friday and then taking it down again.
Well, and we were really kind to the people who made that show, because we would often record just as traffic in and around Soho really got to the point where people were taking out all of their day's anger on their horn.
Yeah, Friday.
Our office is one of the busiest corners in Soho, and doing it on a Friday was really just, it was a miserable experience for the sound people, because people start leaning on their horns on that corner at about 1 o'clock in the afternoon trying to get out of the city, and boy, oh boy, it could get loud.
Yeah, people just heading for the tunnel and the bridge, just trying to get out.
A couple times that we recorded stuff in the office back in the day, you know, I haven't been down to New York since before the pandemic, but when we recorded, I mean, just trying to keep your cool, when you would finally get your memorized line and the beats perfect, and then the third word from the end, somebody would blast a horn, you know, 30 feet below, and you'd just be like, all right, this is the day I kill someone. I don't know who it's going to be. I'm going to find somebody. It's probably the guy that just honked his horn.
There's a surprising number of trucks going through that intersection with, I don't know what kind of horns they have. I mean, I'm not a truck horn specialist. I'm sure that they're out there. But, you know, these, like, it sounds like some sort of giant air horn that would be more suitable for use on a super tanker than on a truck.
Yeah. Sometimes it's just absolutely insane. And you're like, you're in a room that's hot and padded so that it's quiet, and maybe the AC's been shut off for an hour because that's how long you've been recording. And you're feeling very bad for the people who are sitting directly behind the camera, who are always very nice, but are also kind of like, you know, if you'd gotten this right like six tries ago, then we wouldn't be worrying about this specific horn, would we? So sometimes it can be stressful, but I think shooting these is an interesting thing, and you guys are able probably to batch shoot a bunch of them. Maybe the technical side of it's not super interesting to those outside, but how many questions are we getting, and how do you kind of pick which ones to go with?
They're sort of funneled in, I think. Nick kind of goes through the first batch and removes the ones that would not be all that entertaining or far too specific. And then Jack and Davey kind of go through and pick the ones that seem the most interesting. And then there are always some game day decisions, which are a lot of fun.
For sure. Yeah. I mean, my guess is a good 75% are like, should I buy this watch or this watch? And it's always like two watches that are kind of good watches, but aren't like fascinating things to then report back on. Do I buy an Explorer or an OP? And you're like, ask me if you want to be buried in your watch, apparently.
That's actually a question that never really occurred to me either. And this is one of the things that I really enjoy about doing the show, is some of the stuff that comes in, I'm like, I never would have thought to ask that. I mean, I don't know, John, would you want to be buried in a watch?
Probably not. I don't think so. Yeah, I'd rather let someone else go ahead and enjoy that watch. I don't think I'll need it anymore.
Actually, one of the first things I pitched, I didn't really know that much about watches, but I liked the clever title, was I was like, how about a story called You Can Take It With You, which is all about who's been buried in their watch.
I can't think of too many examples. I mean, there's Günter Blümlein, who is one of the co-founders of modern Langenzone. I mean, really the driving force behind it. And he's buried in his, what is it, a platinum datagraph?
Yeah. I mean, if I had like revived a brand and was like, you know, responsible for it more or less, then maybe my views on it would be different. But as it stands, I'm only wearing watches, not making them. So,
yeah, I think Shelley's poem Ozymandias about seeing a giant statue of the pharaoh in the desert, and on the base of the statue it says, "I am Ozymandias, king of kings. Look on my works, ye mighty, in despair," and all around the colossal wreck, you know, stretches trackless desert, and there's nothing left but defeat. So I kind of feel like, yeah, I don't want to be that guy.
I think to get to that level, you can't be buried with a watch. It's like one on your wrist. They just need to shovel them all next to you into the box. Just kind of sprinkle them in there for just like a, like being buried with a small fortune.
And then like hundreds of years later, just when the archaeologists come, they'll be like, we found a box of watches with like a little skeleton kind of watch discovery.
Yeah, actually, that's something. I mean, not to give it away, but that's something that Nora and I kind of got into in the actual episode. You know, it's like it's a slippery slope, right? Because I mean, first it starts with a watch, and then it's like all of your watches, and then it's all of your watches plus like your favorite dog, and then it's your favorite dog and your favorite horse, and then like the person who designed your tomb, and you know, your favorite concubines, and
whoever knows all your secrets.
Oh, yeah,
where does it end?
Yeah, it's true. Yeah, at a certain point, you just you got to take it all, or you got to take nothing. And I think, Nora, where do you land on this? You got to read the question, so I'm sure it's been kicking around in your brain for the last little while.
I don't think I would not be buried with my watch. I would have my body turned into a diamond put on someone else's watch.
Okay. This I like.
I think that could
like
be
on the crown or one of the hour markers.
Yeah, one of the 12, you know, just so it's always
sure.
Like, all right.
Yeah, thanks. Of course, for sure.
I feel like you would make a fine cabochon.
Thank you, Jack.
It's a very sweet thing to say, for sure. Within the parlance of this specific podcast, that's a very nice thing to say.
I'm going to pull that into my obituary while I'm being turned into a diamond. Yeah, I don't know. I feel like it seems dangerous to be buried with a very expensive watch, but if you had like just sort of a Timex that you kicked around in every day, I think it would be kind of nice to be buried as you were.
I like the idea of being buried with like a simple watch, almost like another little tribute to time, your time has ended or something like that. But I did think my perspective was almost the opposite, where I would like to be, I think I would be okay with being buried with watches if they were good enough that someone might dig me up. I like the idea of grave robbers. Like in reality, when I pass, I will enter a moment of extreme irrelevance. Like this is the end of, you know, the point, right? For me. And I think it'd be funny to know, like, well, if I put enough watches in there, if I take the right one with me, someone might come visit.
Well, and you know, like watchmaking, grave robbing is a fine, archaic, anachronistic way to make a living.
Yeah, I think that I could see there is an overlap in the Venn between deep watch collectors and people who have considered robbing a grave, for sure.
And also living on in the memories of your family as one of the most spiteful people, where you could ask everyone what they most like to inherit and then take it with you.
Come in the box, put it in the box.
Oh my gosh, wow.
That's one way to do it. Lots of options.
You have that Wes Anderson-esque reading of the will. Everybody's there, but they're sitting in a dark room, kind of disparate, not that close. A fight might break out.
What's the cutoff for watch value that would inspire grave robbery? Is it a $10,000 watch, $20,000, $100,000? Would you rob a grave for a Submariner? Would you not rob a grave for a Submariner, but you would rob a grave for a Nautilus? Does it depend on the fluctuation of prices on the pre-owned market? I mean, so many things to consider.
Are you getting buried with boxes and paper? Because that's going to change the value.
What if you were buried in a 5711 in like 2016, but you know, by 2021, it's, you know, it's a totally different situation. Yeah.
Oh my goodness. Yeah, a whole different world. Plus, then you could get a coffin that's made out of like the cork, which is kind of like the Nautilus box.
Ooh, you could box yourself like the box.
Yeah, if you had like a special speedy, you could have a bright red coffin. Sounds rad. Never seen that done, so I'm on board for sure.
I would be very surprised if there wasn't some like insane paddock collector out there who didn't want to get buried in like a man-sized cork Nautilus box.
Sounds awesome. It's like it's your last chance to have a race car.
This is the most macabre episode of Hoonicky Radio I've ever been a part of, I have to say, by the way.
John, I'm pretty jet-lagged. And I've had a lot of coffee. Anyways, I don't know that we could take this a whole lot further or that anyone would want us to. I do want to know, Jack, do you have any tips? And Nora, do you have any tips for people who want to get their question on the show? Best case, you've done a few, maybe you've been through, 50, maybe 25, 30 questions at this point. Is there a tone line that kind of connects them? Not too specific, but also, you know, somewhat morbid.
Yeah. Death, sex, and taxes, if you can work those into your questions. Yeah. Not super specific. I think giving Jack, I don't know, Jack, if you like questions where you're like, I can come down with a specific watch and that's the answer. But I kind of like when something gives Jack the opportunity to dig into history or put something in context, like pulling out just a little bit, there's kind of a tidbit that can be mined in it.
Yeah, it's you know, I mean, that's kind of like to talk about what I like to write about when it comes to watches and anything that kind of that sort of touches on a a slightly larger world. Certainly, if you're talking about what watch you want to be buried in, that touches on questions of mortality and, you know, how you sort of represent yourself in the afterlife, life. But one of the things I am thinking about doing is some of the questions I can't really answer because it's a fairly short format and they're questions that are just, that would require too lengthy an answer. So what I may try to do is answer some of the Heihōdinki questions in writing rather than on a 3 to 5 minute video, because I think that they're questions with a lot of merit. And just because I've heard a question before doesn't mean it's not worth asking and worth answering again. You know, I've been doing this for a disgracefully long time, and you know, beyond a certain point, you feel like you've written every story that you can possibly write, and you're just rephrasing things. But you know, people are coming into the watch world, coming into watch collecting at an astonishing rate nowadays. I mean, I never thought, you know, 20 years ago, if somebody had told me that my little hobby would be this big a deal, you know, sort of, and on a global stage, no less, I would have bet real money against it. So I think that some of these more general questions that I might feel like have been addressed and don't need to be addressed again, I think they actually do need to be addressed again. And then the watchmaking landscape changes too. What was true 20 years ago is not true today.
Also, if you can set Jack up to sing, that will also help get it in the video. Shameless plug for the magazine. Your question could get in the magazine. There's a lot of written Heihōdinki in there where stuff is really meaty and interesting. So something to noodle on.
Yeah. So find a thread, but leave enough for Jack's curiosity to do most of the work. And Jack, if you end up with questions that you think would be best left to a group of people, we can do a Heihōdinki radio. That's just the deep questions or the long questions or the offcuts. We'll find a name for it, I'm sure.
Offcuts.
The offcuts, yeah.
You are jet lagged.
Okay, let's do a new topic. All right, so the other thing that's come up on the site recently that I've really been enjoying, because I read them all as a back-to-back, is the Watch of the Week stuff. So this is the idea of just to highlight a watch that a specific personality within the kind of Heihōdinki space feels strongly about. Not necessarily that they even own or have owned. Maybe they want to. Maybe it's just one that they like the backstory of or whatever. And so far, I mean, Ben kicked it off with a really great piece about his Reverso, which is a really fun story about kind of entering a different part of watches than he had kind of started in, which I love watches that bridge you into other aspects, whether if you're a dive watch guy, maybe it's your first big dress watch. If it's in Ben's case, this was kind of his first modern nice watch, which was a good one. And then we had a cool one from Logan about this really funky Zin. That's like a hunting theme Zin, which is super cool. And then the one that I think probably would be the most useful for us today is Gary Steingart was kind enough to write us a piece about his kind of continued love and reverence of Patek 3940 in white gold, which is a really beautiful but very subtle perpetual calendar from Patek. And I like this one because he kind of gets into an area of discussion that I spend a lot of time thinking about. And it's this idea of, should I get rid of most of what I've amassed in getting to know watches and learn about watches and love watches for a big purchase? And in this case, he's talking about kind of the differences between keeping what he's got or selling almost everything to get a 3940 and holding on to a Nomos and an Aquanaut that he has as sort of alternatives for either when he's swimming, which he likes to do, or traveling to areas where you might not want to take something like an Aquanaut, or in this case, a 3940. What did you guys think about this piece? Where do you stand on the 3940? We can start there.
Yeah, I mean, the 3940 is a real classic. And I love this piece because it kind of brought it back to where, like, Gary kind of came into our world when he was researching, watch collectors, and wrote a fantastic piece for The New Yorker in which Heihōdinki was mentioned. I think Jack was directly quoted in that story. And yeah, so it's a little bit of the backstory of how that story was researched, and that's, you should go read the article on our site if you're interested. But yeah, I mean, I think, you know, Gary obviously is a fantastic writer. He's hilarious, I would say, and just the notion of becoming like a one watch person is something that I think a lot of us have thought about. It's kind of like a romantic thing, you know, what would you do if you had to just take one watch and really just kind of live with it and be happy with it? What would it be? And so to entertain that in the context of this new rubric that we've launched, Watch of the Week, I thought was a really smart idea. And Gary, I'll read, you know, virtually anything Gary writes. I've read, you know, one of his books, and I read most of the stuff he writes in The New Yorker. And it's just great to see his byline on Hodinkee.
Absolutely. You know, oddly enough, as an aside, I've been rewatching through all of No Reservations and was delighted because a handful of Hodinkee kind of general personalities kind of pop up in the show early on. And then he's in the New York episode as they go to a Russian area like Brighton Beach or something like that. And really, really fantastic. Just to say, oh, hey, look, it's Gary. It's kind of exciting. I don't know Gary well enough to like text him about it and be like, hey, I saw you on a show that you recorded 10 years ago. But, you know, I really like it when he does this sort of stuff. And I also like that he speaks in the piece with this concept of it would be fun to have your day-to-day watch be a watch that kind of has to be worn in that it's an automatic perpetual. He doesn't want to put it on a winder. He wants to make this, keep it alive by wearing it. And I like he aligns this thought by saying it's a Fosterian sort of position. Jack, where do you land on this? Do you think he captured some of the Jackness of it all?
You know, I think, well, first of all, I think that the three watches he proposes as his sort of end game are, I mean, it's really hard to think how you would improve on that. And, they're matched really, really nicely to his lifestyle. He swims a heroic distance every day, by the way, 1 to 2 hours. If you follow his Instagram, you can see him consuming probably, I don't know, thousands of calories of delicious food every day. And the guy could take a bath in a shotgun barrel. I mean, he definitely burns it off. I don't know. I find the idea of, I love the idea of getting down to what's really like essential in the watches that you have. And I love the idea of a day-to-day relationship. But for me, it's a very theoretical love because, you know, the reality is I look at the tops of the dresser in my bedroom, and you can't see the wood for all of the watches and ancillary watch crap that's piled up on it. And the top of the air conditioner in my bedroom probably has, I'm not kidding, 20 solar-powered G-Shocks on it, just like sitting there with their faces turned towards the sun like so many daffodils. I mean, it's absurd. And I think to myself, I mean, this is 20 years of, you know, hunting around. And if I see, I mean, I fall in love with watches really easily. And I still, on a certain level, I love absolutely everything that I've got. And I don't want to deacquisition anything. And it seems like too much work anyway. And every once in a while, I think about taking all the G-Shocks into the office and just, you know, like keep one or two. Like, you know, there's a Range Band that I really like. There's a couple of older, you know, diver models that I really like. But see, then that's how the thought process goes. I'm like, well, not that one. Yeah, and not that one. And probably not that one. Oh, and this one's cool. Oh, and this one reminds me of, you know, this particular event. And this one reminds me of this trip that I took. And, oh, this was my backup watch that one time I went to Iceland and bought two really expensive watches with me and only ended up wearing the G-Shock the whole time. I mean, I can't seem to get rid of them. For all that I love the idea of having, you know, three watches from a philosophical standpoint, I find myself absolutely immobilized by the sheer number of them for which I would have to find a good home. And I feel like I can't just like put them out and say, hey, you know, people take these.
It's so hard. The only context I've ever parted with watches was so that I could have money to buy an additional watch. Like that's like, I never like get rid of them. I always, if I ever sell them, it's for sure to like fund another one.
Yeah. You know, John, when I think of someone with a really tight, thoughtful collection, it's like yours comes to mind.
Oh, thank you.
Because it seems like you'd really take your time when you buy watches. I will buy on a whim. I will buy on a jet-lagged eBay purchase that could definitely happen sometime today. All bets are off, really, at any point. And I feel like when I walk into Jack's office, I've not been to Jack's home to see his garden of G-Shocks, but when I walk into Jack's office, I do feel some kinship with... If somebody asked you for the watch that wasn't on your wrist, you'd kind of turn around and you'd go, "Well, it's not there. Oh, here it is. It's on. I put it on this book, or it's around. But there's things kind of amassed, and I would have the same issue where I can look at all of them and go, "Well, Lord knows I don't need all of these, but where do I start cutting?" And John, when you're picking a watch, do you find that just because it's kind of new and there, that can be enough, or is there it has to fit a mold for you?
It's somewhere in the middle. I mean, sometimes it's because it has to fit a mold. Sometimes just because it's like, wow, this is great. I want it. But typically a good amount of thought goes into it. It's, you know, I don't buy things on a whim, really. I mean, I think a watch just has to kind of call to me for a little while and I have to like really want it to part with, you know, my money for it. That was certainly the case with, you know, I mean, I bought a Rolex a couple of years ago and that was something that I like wanted badly for a while. Same thing with a Tudor, Black Bay 58 I bought Yeah, those are like my two big watches that I bought recently. And then I guess the Grand Seiko GMT would be like the other one that I would be a big one for me. But I'm not like, I think you and Jack definitely strike me as guys who have more watches than I do, I think.
A problem? We can just use the, yeah. We can use the easy terminology here.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think it's a good thing. I think you guys are enjoying life and enjoying your watches.
when I was reading this piece of Gary's, I was thinking, you know, I could see coming to this a very similar position, like three watches, one, like, well, in Gary's case, all three are pretty big flexes, but I would try and swing for one big flex. But the funny thing is I think I always tell myself I wouldn't bother doing it while I still like am actively working in the watch industry. And like I review watches and I feel like a lot of this keeps my enthusiasm at a certain level of pace. Whereas if I just stopped doing this, I would have to spend the same money on speakers and I only have so many rooms in my house, or spend it on bits to like tack onto my Jeep, and eventually I'll run out of room on that. Like it's this kind of bubbling over that you just have to focus at a certain level. And in some ways it's been watches for a while. Nora, for you, maybe on the earlier side of starting your collection, do you even think about this, or is it like I just want to experience watches when I buy them, and that's more of the point? Like you could save yourself everything that Jack and I are talking about.
I got some very strong advice from Dakota because we were ships in the night before starting here. And he was like, whatever you do, don't buy a watch in your first 6 months. Don't buy a watch in your first year, because you're going to be so thrilled that you just like know what they are, that you are going to like start collecting because you want to like get that thrill. It is helpful, I think, to watch people be like, I wish I could be someone who has fewer watches. Yeah, I don't know. It is my natural instinct is to be like, yeah, I like it. Let's get it. You know, doesn't matter the price range. I think I'll probably find a time to wear it. I'll mix it up, like a different watch for a different day and a different outfit, you know?
Absolutely.
I have wanted to be someone who has a capsule wardrobe and has one watch. And I know that that is just not who I am going to be. So it is kind of I'm trying to slow down that impulse and hopefully land somewhere between the John version of collecting and the James and Jack version of collecting. And also right now I have to buy a couch, so that's keeping me from buying a watch.
And then you can fill it with watch money over time. Mm-hmm. That's what couches are for, I think. But yeah, it is kind of a funny thing to consider, like if you get into this and let's say you're early on and you're collecting and you're at the point where maybe you want to buy 20 Seikos a month for a little while just to feel the burn a little bit, you know, find some pace. But on the other hand, if you just slow down and just read about them, which doesn't cost as much, nearly as much, really, you could kind of pace your way out to more specific pieces. And I've kind of met people who actually did manage to do that. They came to, and nobody avoids the 3 or 4 or 5 or 20 Seikos. Like that's just how life is going to be. You know, you got to walk before you can run, et cetera. But I have met people who were like thoughtful about it from the starting point, about where they wanted their collection to be in 20 years or something like that. And that's like an investor mindset, not in terms of they're worried about their return, but they're thinking on this, like on a scale that outpaces my entire like tenure with watches. And I think I operate a little bit more on the gut, but I'm not sure that's a better way to approach the market.
I mean, feeling the burn, you know, feeling that little burst of serotonin that you get when you know that you've ordered the watch and it's on the way. I mean, it really is. I mean, it's addicting in a very specific, strict neuropsychological sense. You know, I mean, I hate to admit this. I don't hate to admit it, because if I actually hated to admit it, I wouldn't admit it. One of the first stories that I did for Hodinkee back in 2015 was about a Seiko 5. It was called a $75 watch that looks like $1 million. And it was a super popular story. One of the most popular stories we've ever published. And I have literally bought that exact same watch 3 more times over the last 6 years just because... Just because I don't know, because I have a problem. I mean, it's ridiculous. You know, the fourth time that it shows up, you just start to ask yourself, what the hell is wrong with you?
Can we unpack this a little bit? Like, are you buying this watch the exact same model, like reference number for yourself, or are you buying it to give away? Like, do you it's exact? Are you just saying Seiko 5 or this exact same model?
The exact same model.
Are you losing them, or what? I mean, I don't.
No. I just like knowing that one's on the way. You know, if I'm having a tough month, or I'm not feeling particularly good about myself, or, you know, I've just had a fight with one of my kids or with my wife, or for no reason at all. I just like knowing that it's coming in.
And is it like the tracking that is the highest like peak when it's like, all right, it's out for like in the emotional arc of like clicking order to it getting on your wrist. What is the peak? Where do you feel the best?
Out for delivery.
Out for delivery is the best feeling. Yeah. Yeah. That's true of anything that I buy, actually.
Can I ask, James, still noodling on this?
I'm still thinking. I'm not sure. Like when they hand the box to you, that's pretty good. And you're scrambling to see if it came from the right address or if it's like a pair of shoes you bought a while ago that you had also forgotten about.
Out for delivery makes you feel like there's hope for the future, man. You know, if I've read too many articles on climate change, I'm like, I need to order that Seiko 5 again. It's not all bleak.
I need the stability of this one process.
So this is a bit of a tangent, but in starting my collecting, the greatest fear right now for me is losing a watch of monetary value. I'm not going to lose this couch. Like it's, you know, going to stay there. Have you ever lost a watch? And how do you deal with the fear of, like, it can get replaced, it can yada, 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 but, like, losing a watch, and then it's your fault, too. Like, you didn't get it stolen, you lost it. Like, how do you deal with that particular fear?
Insurance makes me feel okay about it, but, yeah, but if it's something that's ultimately irreplaceable, you know, like, you can only get one of these, then just gotta be careful.
I can't wait for Hodinkee Insurance to come to Canada. Right now, it's a much more complicated process for me. The funny thing is the losing a watch, I think that I have to put that in the same category as being buried with your watch as a concern that never came across my mind. I don't think I've ever thought that I could lose one. I misplace a lot of things in my life, but I seldom lose things like permanently in that I can remember a few t-shirts that I wish I still knew where they were. But other than that, things are still roughly in their area. Losing a watch, I don't know. I mean, that's, now that you mention it, I find it scary. Yeah, I have some anxiety over this. I'm wondering if I've lost one and just didn't realize it.
Every once in a while, I'm going through my closet and I find a watch that I've forgotten that I own.
Yeah.
That's happened to me once or twice.
That's something I don't love admitting, but if I'm with Jack on this one, I definitely can go through my watch cabinet every 6 months and be like, forgot I had that.
I mean, I have lost nothing of any significant value, but I have lost watches maybe twice over the last 20 years. And when you can't help yourself from accumulating as many of the damn things as I have, I suppose it's kind of inevitable. But I'm also really good at abdicating responsibility and shifting blame to other people in other circumstances. So that's usually my first reflex is, well, it wasn't my fault, man.
This series of scenarios happened, in which case this was inevitable and I was a victim.
Yeah. Who's the real victim here? Is it the watch or is it me?
It's a fair question. Fair question. It is a funny thing, the whole concept, not only of losing the watch, but of this kind of concern where not only, maybe not even without a dream watch on the other side, this like concern for what's the right size of a quote unquote collection, or how many watches, too many watches. At what point, if you're not, say, wearing them, should you move them on to another owner? That sort of, like, the question comes up a lot in the community. And, we've got a few minutes left and I still want to get to at least one more topic we've got on the list here, but if you guys were to make that play, let's say sell 80, 90% of what you've got, what would be the watch that could fill that big hole in the collection, even just at first glance? Because it's a kind of a tough question, but...
Probably I'd keep my GMT Master too, my Batman, just because, you know, when I think about the GMT Master, I often think about our magazine story we did a while ago with Bruce Talman and how he wore his GMT for so long, and how I really do. I mean, it's a very sporty watch, of course. It's like not a dress watch, a GMT, a Rolex, but I really do think it is the kind of watch that you can, like, you know, can be worn all the time. It's a travel watch. I know, you know, you're with me, James, in terms of like the versatility of a GMT.
Love it, for sure.
Yeah, I think if I were going to have one watch, it would have to be a GMT, and it would be that one.
Jack, what do you think? If you had to prune the G-Shocks, clean off the dresser top, make some room, make a lot of room for one or two more watches, what are you thinking? Anything come to mind?
You know, not a day goes by that I don't consider this question, and not a day goes by that I find it completely impossible to answer, because, you know, one of the things I've realized about myself over the years is that and this is one of the things that makes writing about watches interesting, you know, to me, is that I tend to create kind of mental associations with things pretty readily. And I can't, the moment I think about a watch, I think about all of the other watches that are similar to it, but which I also like because they share certain formal characteristics with that particular watch. Like, for instance, I have a Gold Tank LC and it reminds me of Reversos, and I don't own a Reverso right now, but I'd like to own a Reverso. And then I think about the Reversos and I think go back to Cartier, and I think about the Tank Basculant, which I also think is a fabulous watch. And then I start thinking about, like, you know, sort of like mid-20th century to like the 1970s ultra thin gold watches in general, and I realize I don't own a Corum gold watch, gold coin watch, and you know, it just sort of goes on and on and on, and before I know it, I've, you know, put up the blinds so that the G-Shocks can get their daily dose of sunlight, and I have failed once again to make anything even remotely resembling a rational decision. Or an irrational decision, for that matter.
You start off with a plan to trim, and you end up with a plan to expand. And maybe that just means your collection's not big enough yet. You're not where Gary's at.
Or maybe that means that I will go to my grave without knowing what it feels like to be decisive about watches for once in my life.
We can throw them all in the box with you if that's what you want, Jeff.
Thanks.
No problem. Nora, how about you? Any kind of grails on the horizon now? Something you would dream of having, even if you didn't have to sell anything?
Yeah, I mean, if I were to sell every watch I own, I could probably get a really nice Seiko. And then for grail watches, I really like that AP Black Ceramic that just came out in the 34 millimeter. Yeah, sell a lot of couches for that.
That's a great watch.
Mm-hmm. That's a watch you could be buried in, no question. Nobody would question that. And the robbers would want to know.
Oh, for sure.
Know where.
They'd dig it up.
You get a matching headstone in black ceramic. I love this idea. Maybe don't even put any words on it, so it's like the thing from 2001. Just leave a spare femur at the base of it. It's almost Halloween, right?
A little bit spooky.
This is a related question. I mean, would you have a headstone or a grave marker shaped like a watch? Is that the ultimate cheesy postmortem flex? This has been quite an episode of Hodinkee Radio, by the way. We've touched on death, we've touched on loss, we've touched on addiction, we've touched on neurochemistry. I mean, wow.
Yeah, and then as far as I'm concerned, to, you know, put a button on this topic, this super fun topic, I could definitely see myself selling everything for just a couple watches. And in my book, I would want to hang on to my Explorer 2 Seiko dive watch and then grab something kind of, you know, like I mentioned in a recent chat with Cole on the show, something needlessly resplendent, probably like a Longa 1, like a solid gold. I like with the solid case back Longa 1s as well, the earlier. I thought those are pretty rad. I could see it, yeah, a tank, a solid gold tank. It'd be something solid gold and like too classy. So if I needed the watch to say something that I'm not capable of saying, that would be the move for sure. I think that's the direction I would go. We are getting towards the end of the show, and I did want to get to one more topic. So let's end on a high note with Pilot's watches. John had suggested chatting about this new IWC Pilot's watch that was made with Collective. John, you want to fill us in on that? This is a story that I only kind of tangentially caught through Instagram on the flight.
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, Collective, as probably some of the listeners know, is like this Silicon Valley founded collector group, and they do limited editions with watch brands. I think so far they've done one with Urwerk, one with J.N. Shapiro. I think that there was a Zenith, and there may be one other one I'm missing. But the most recent one is IWC. They did a Pilot watch that kind of looks back to the reference 3706, which is one of the early, you know, mid-1990s IWC chronographs. And I think they did a really good job with this collaboration. It's, you know, stainless steel, very simple black dial, stark white, very, you know, highly legible numerals and displays. And it's just it's a nice watch. It's 41 millimeters, and it's really just these two guys, Gabe and Asher, the founders, looking at their, you know, one of their favorite brands, one of their favorite eras of that brand, and one of their favorite models from that time. And it's not like an exact kind of, it's not a replica of the 3706, that's for sure. In fact, IWC did something a little bit closer 3 years ago when they did an e-commerce exclusive version that was much closer in terms of aesthetics to that 1990s watch. But it's just a, you know, a sweet watch. It's limited though. It's 125 pieces, so there won't be a ton of them, but it's the kind of watch that when you see it, you're like, or at least I was like, that would be great to see in the mainline collection of IWC. I mean, they have a lot of great Pilot's watches already, but this is kind of vaulted to the front of of my favorites in the Pilot's watch.
Yeah, when I came across it on Instagram, I was kind of like, isn't this watch already in IWC's current collection? And of course, it isn't. That's not my point. My point is rather, it feels perfect.
Yeah,
like it's called the C.03. And so the 01 was an El Primero, and the 02 was a Moser Pioneer.
Right, Moser, yeah.
And so we have this one. It's got like a, I really like the caseback treatment, is an open caseback with like a black rotor, which looks really sharp and really matches the like the stark legibility of the front of the watch. Obviously, a 41 millimeter Pilot's chronograph is going to suit a lot of people. It's $7,150 on a strap, $1,500 more if you want a bracelet. Both of those seem pretty reasonable given where IWC is right now, and you're getting an in-house movement, which is the 69385. So that's a 46-hour power reserve. Yeah, I think this is a solid thing. I think that in many ways, IWC has been moving back towards this design over the last few years with the rebirth of the Spitfire stuff and the newer Pilot stuff and the return to some of the Mark aesthetics. But you still get kind of a pointy hour hand on this one, which I think is really lovely versus the kind of squared off option that also exists in their history. Jack, have you ever owned one of these in the past? We were talking about collections a few moments ago.
You know, I've never owned an IWC Pilot's chronograph, but this watch definitely reminds me of, you know, I look at it and this is what I think of when I think of IWC from, you know, back in the 1990s, early 2000s. I think of, you know, pretty austere, pretty stripped down, very function forward, no extraneous frills, wristwatches. And I've always thought of IWC as kind of a monochromatic brand in a good way. You know, I mean, to me, it's a brand in black and white. And, you know, I mean, I shoot black and white film. I love black and white photography. It's got kind of the same feel to it. You know, I think that you can, I think we often underestimate just how much bang for the buck you can get out of a monochromatic palette. And I love it. I love it. I love the fact that it's kind of everything you need and nothing that you don't.
Yeah. And I mean, the nice thing is being from the lineage of the IWC Pilot's watch, these are watches that are almost in my mind define the sort of like strap monster moniker that gets thrown around for a lot of watches, in that this is a sporty watch that on the bracelet looks one way, on this sort of Kevlar fabric strap looks a lot different. And if you went the kind of big Pilot route and put it on a studded leather or even an alligator, it's going to dress it up a little bit. Like, you know, not fully dressy, but maybe like you go to a party in LA or something like that, where it's a kind of a mixed vibe. I think this is a good one. Where do you land on this, Nora? You like these?
Yeah, this is not very much not my ministry, but I think it is well executed. And I do like the monochromatic black and white.
I also just wanted, I like the German day wheel too. That was like a nice touch, you know? I mean, that's something that you don't see too much. It was really just, I think these guys wanting to make like their perfect kind of like, you know, their platonic ideal of an IWC watch. And so, you know, congrats to them. They did really well.
Yeah, I think they've done a good job with everything that I've seen. They do these low production because I think you have to be part of the group to get access to be able to buy the watch. So it's a sort of closed loop where they're just serving a small niche. And so they kind of have this flexibility to make these little changes that might not work for a more general audience. And I think the result of that is it like an interesting, characterful watch. And I think what's kind of also remarkable is that you can see that character in a watch that's pretty stoic in its layout, in its coloring, in all of that. But you still like it does kind of feel special and cool. And yeah, I would agree, John. I think they did a nice job with it for sure.
You know what this reminds me of? That when I was a kid, I could say the days of the week in German and I've forgotten them.
Oh, no. I didn't know you forgot things, Jack.
Well, you know, there's only so much room up there. Even the biggest and dustiest attic starts to fill up after a while.
You can only have so many Emily Dickinson quotes in one place.
That's right.
And yeah, so on that lofty point, I think we'll probably close out the show, you know, put a bow on it with a lovely IWC. Nora, Jack, John, it was a treat to have the three of you on. Thanks so much.
Thank you, James.
Thank you, James.
Always a pleasure.
We'll be back in a week's time. If you have any feedback, leave it in the comments below. And if you're liking the show, please tell a friend. Chat to you soon.